Chapter 22. This is ancient patience, belly down on the muds lining the Liana shore. Everyone must cross rivers in high flood. Bright blossoms float past on the way down to the snake mangroves harbouring the warm sea. But nothing slides smooth into the swirling waters hunting their bold beauty. We mill uneasy on the verge, awaiting necessity's paroxysms, the sudden rush to cross into the future. Rivers in high flood dream of red passages, and the lizards will feed as they have always done. We bank on numbers, the chaotic tumult, the frenzied path on the backs of loved ones, fathers and mothers, the quill lickers inscribing lists of lives, this solid stand, that slippage of desire. Ancient patience swells the tongue, all the names written in tooth-row jaws. We surge, we clamber, eyes rolling, and the distant shore calls to us, that ribbed future holds us a place in waiting. But the river scrolls down high in its hungry season, and the lizards wallow fat in the late afternoon sun. See me now in the fleck of their lazy regard, and now I wait with them for the coming rains. The Season of High Flood, Gamas Enictodon. Children will wander. They will walk as if the future did not exist. Among adults, the years behind one force focus upon what waits ahead, but with children this is not so. The past was a blur of befuddled sensations, the future was white as the face of the sun. Knowing this yielded no comfort. Badal was still a child, should one imagine her of a certain age, but she walked like a crone, tottering, hobbling. Even her voice belonged to an old woman, and the dull, fused thing behind her eyes could not be shaken awake. She had a vague recollection, a memory or an invention, of looking upon an ancient woman, a grandmother perhaps, or a great aunt, lying shrunken on a bed, swaddled in wool blankets, still breathing, still blinking, still listening. And yet those eyes, in their steady watching, their grainy observation, showed nothing. The stare of a dying person. Eyes spanning a gulf, slowly losing grip on the living side of the chasm, soon to release and slide to the side of death. Did those eyes feed thoughts, or had things reduced to mere impressions, blobs of colour, blurred motions, as if in the closing of death one simply returned to the way things had been for a newborn? She could think of a babe's eyes, in the moments and days after arriving in the world, seeing but not seeing. A face of false smiles, the innocence of not knowing. She had knelt beside a nameless boy, there on the very edge of the crystal city, and had stared into his eyes, knowing he saw her, but knowing nothing else. He was beyond expression. Oh, the horror of that, to see a human face beyond expression, to wonder who was trapped inside and why they'd given up getting out. He'd studied her in turn, she could see that much, and held her gaze, as if he'd wanted company in his last moments of life. She would not have turned away, not for anything. The gift was small for her, but all she had, and for him, perhaps it was everything. Was it as simple as that? In dying, did he offer, there in his eyes, a blank slate, upon which she could scribble anything she liked, anything and everything that eased her own torment? She'd find those answers when her death drew close. And she knew she too would remain silent, watchful, revealing nothing. And her eyes would look both beyond and within, and in looking within, she would find her private truths, truths that belonged to her and no one else. Who cared to be generous in those final moments? She'd be past easing anyone else's pain. And this was Badal's deepest fear, to be so selfish with the act of dying. She'd not even seen when the life left the boy's eyes. Somehow, that moment was itself a most private revelation. Recognition was slow, uncertainty growing leaden as she slowly comprehended that the eyes she stared into gave back not a single glimmer of light.
Gone. He is gone.
Sunlight cut paths through the prisms of crystal walls, giving his still face a rainbow mask. He had probably been no more than 10 years old. He'd come so far only to fail at the very threshold of salvation.
What do we living know about true irony?
His face was leather skin pulled taut over bones. The huge eyes belonged to someone else. He'd lost his eyelashes, his eyebrows. Had he been remembering those times before this march, that other world? She doubted it. She was older, and she remembered very little. Patchy images, wrought dreams crowded with impossible things. Thick green leaves, a garden, amphorae with glistening flanks, something wonderful in her mouth. A tongue free of sores, lips devoid of splits, a flashing smile. Were any of these things real? Or did they belong to her fantastic dreams that haunted her now, day and night?
I grow wings. I fly across the world, across many worlds. I fly into paradise and leave desolation in my wake, because I feed on all that I see. I devour it whole. I am discoverer and destroyer both. Somewhere awaits the great tomb, the final home of my soul. I will find it yet. Tomb, palace, when you're dead, what's the difference? There I will reside forever, embraced by my insatiable hunger.
She'd dreamed of children, looking down from a great height, watching them march in their tens of thousands. They had cattle, mules, and oxen. Many rode horses. They glittered blindingly in the hard sunlight, as if they bore the treasures of the world on their backs. Children, but not her children. And then the day ended and darkness bled to the earth, and she dreamed that it was at last time to descend, spiraling, moaning through the air. She would strike swiftly, and if possible, unseen by any. There were magics below, in that vast, multi-limbed camp. She had to avoid brushing those. If need be, she would kill to silence, but this was not her true task. She dreamed her eyes, and she had more of those than she should, no matter, fixed upon the two burning spots she sought. Bright golden hearth flames. She had been tracking them for a long time now, in service to the commands she had been given. She was descending upon the children, to steal fire. Strange dreams, yes, but it seemed they existed for a reason. The deeds done within them had purpose, and this was more than anything real could manage. The quitters had been driven away, by song, by poems, by words. Braderal, the betrayer among them, had vanished into the city. Rut oversaw the ribby survivors, and everyone slept in cool rooms in buildings facing onto a broad fountain, in the centre of which stood a crystal statue weeping the sweetest water. It was never quite enough, not for them all, and the basin of the surrounding pool was fissured with cracks that drank with endless thirst. But they were all managing to drink just enough to stay alive. Behind a glittering building they'd found an orchard, the trees of a type none had seen before. Fruits massed on the branches, each one long and sheathed in a thick skin the colour of dirt. The pulp within was soft and impossibly succulent. It filled the stomach with no pangs. They'd quickly eaten them all, but the next day Sadik had found another orchard, bigger than the first one, and then yet another. Starvation had been eluded, for now. Of course, they continued to eat those children who, for whatever reason, still died. No one could think of wasting anything, never again. Badal walked the empty streets closer to the city's heart. A palace occupied the centre, the only structure in the city that had been systematically destroyed, smashed down as if with giant mallets and hammers. From the mounds of shattered crystals, Badal had selected a shard as long as her forearm. Having wrapped rags around one end, she now held a makeshift weapon. Braderal was still alive. Braderal still wanted to see them all dead. Badal meant to find her first, find her and kill her. As she walked, she whispered her special poem, Braderal's poem, her poem of killing.
Where is my child of justice? I have a knife that will speak true to the very heart. Where is my child of justice, spat out so righteously on a world meant to kneel in slavery? Where is my child of justice? I want to read your proof of what you say you deserve. I will see your knife Where is my child of justice? Let us lock blades. You claim whatever you please. I claim no right but you.
She had sailed down in her dreams. She had stolen fire. No blood had been shed, no magics were awakened. The children slept on, seeing nothing, peaceful in ignorance. When they awoke, they would face the rising sun and begin the day's march. By this detail alone, she knew that these children were indeed strangers. She'd looked upon the boy until life left him. Then, with Rut and Sadiq and 24 others, she had eaten him. Chewing on the stringy, bloody meat, she thought back to that look in his eyes, knowing, calm, revealing nothing. An empty gaze cannot accuse, but the emptiness was itself an accusation, wasn't it? When Sadiq looked upon the city they'd found in the heart of the glass desert, he believed he was seeing the structure of his very own mind, a pattern writ on a colossal scale, but in its crystalline form it was nevertheless the same as that which was encased in his own skull. Seeking proof of this notion, he'd left the others behind, even Badal, and set out to explore, not from street to street, but downward. He soon discovered that most of the city was below ground. The crystals had settled deep roots, and whatever light was trapped within prismatic walls up above sent down deeper, softer hues that flowed like water. The air was cool, tasteless, neither dry nor damp. He felt as if he walked a world between breaths, moving through that momentary pause that hovered motionless on all sides, and not even the muted slap of his bare feet could break this sense of eternal hesitation. Vast caverns waited at the very base, a dozen or more levels down from the surface, crystal walls and domed ceilings, and as Sadiq edged into the first of these, he understood the secret purpose of this city. It wasn't enough to build a place in which to live, a place with the comforting crowds of one's own kind. It wasn't even enough to fashion things of beauty out of mundane necessity. The pretty fountains, the perfect orchards with their perfect rows of ancient trees, the rooms of startling light as the sun's glow was trapped and given new flavors, the tall statues of tusked demons with their stern yet resolved expressions, and the magical way the sun made vertical pupils in those glittering eyes, as if the statues watched still, alive inside the precise angles of translucent stone. None of these were sufficient reason for building this city. The revelation of the true secret was down here, locked away and destined to survive until oblivion itself came to devour the sun. Above, on the surface, the buildings, the domes and spires and tilted towers, the rooms and the plazas and spiral staircases, they each marked the perfect placement of a single enormous machine. A machine of light and colours, but not just light, not just colours. Sadiq walked into the cavern, breathless with wonder. Each day, each moment he could manage, Sadiq listened to the words of Badal. He listened and he watched, and all that he heard and all that he saw passed through his surface, shifted and bounced, curled and bent until reaching the caverns of his memory, where they reformed, precise and exact, destined to live on, secure in perfection for as long as Sadiq himself remained alive. But this city had defeated mortality, and, he realized, it had defeated time as well. Far above, the sun's light fed the city's memories. All the life it had once held within its chambers and halls, on its streets and in the squares with their fountains. The chaotic angles of the walls around him flowed with scenes, murky and ghostly, not of Rut and the children now dwelling above, but of the inhabitants of long, long ago, persisting here for all eternity. They were tall, with skin the colour of lichen. Their lower jaws bore tusks that rose up to frame the thin-lipped mouths. Men and women both wore long, loose clothing, dyed in deep but vibrant colours. They wore braided belts of grey leather, weaponless, and nowhere could Sadiq see armour. This was a city of peace, and everywhere there was water, flowing down building walls, swirling in pools surrounding fountains. Blossom-filled gardens bled their riotous colours into rooms and down colonnaded hallways. Sadiq walked through cavern after cavern, seeing all that had once been, but nowhere could he find those moments that must have preceded the city's death, or rather the fall of the tusked people and their rich culture. Invaders? Desert savages? He could find nothing but the succession of seemingly endless days of perfection and tranquility. The scenes seemed to seep into his mind, as if impressing themselves upon his own crystalline brain, and he began to comprehend details of things he had no way of knowing. He came to discover the city's name. He saw the likeness in the statues and realized that they all belonged to the same individual, and that variations arose solely from the eyes of the sculptors and their skill as artists. And as he drew closer to what he knew was the center of the city, to its most cherished heart, he now saw other creatures. In what seemed peaceful coexistence, huge two-legged reptiles began appearing in scenes. These were the ones Badal had spoken about, the ones who had found the city. But Sadiq now knew more than she did. They'd found it, yes, but it had not been empty. In finding it, they found the ones who dwelt in it, who called it their home.
They were called Jaghut, returned to this way of living in the cities they had abandoned long before. They were drawn to a humble man, a half-blood. They were drawn to his great machine of memories, this place he made by his own hand. What he did not possess within him, he built around him, to trap all that he was. The city is called Icarius.
He left a cavern, walked down a twisting passage murky with dark hues, and came upon the buried heart of the city. Sadiq cried out. Before him, in a chamber more massive than any of the others,
"Darkness. Destruction."
The roots were dead, unfed by light from above. Fissures split the crystals.
"Broken. His heart is broken."
Braderal sat, knees drawn up and arms wrapped tightly round them, in the corner of a small room on the fourth level of a tower. She had escaped her captors, leaving her alone with her grief and torment. She had drawn her kin to their deaths. She should have killed Badal long ago, the first moment she sensed the power of the girl. Badal had shattered the Inquisitors. She had taken their own words and thrown them back, and precious blood had spilled onto the shard-studded ground. At least two of them had died, the other two retreating with grievous wounds. If they still breathed somewhere out there, it would not be for much longer. They had no food, no water, and no shelter, and each day the sun lit the sky on fire. Badal needed to die. Braderal had raided an orchard not yet found by the others. She could feel her strength returning, her belly full for the first time in months. But guilt and loneliness had stolen all her will. Worse yet, this city itself assailed her. Whatever force still lingered here was inimical to the Fokral assail. A despiser of justice, she could almost taste its contempt for her. Were the others hunting her? She believed they were. And if they found her, they would kill her. They would rend her flesh from her bones and eat until their stomachs were swollen. Perhaps that was fitting. Perhaps, indeed, it served a kind of justice, the kind that recognized the price of failure. Still, could she kill Badal? Rut alone was not enough to oppose her. Sadiq was nothing more than Badal's pet. Standing over Badal's cold corpse, Braderal could command the others to obedience. Yield, kneel, die. Wasn't it what they wanted? The purest peace of all. She stiffened, breath catching, as she heard sounds from somewhere outside. Rising into a crouch, Braderal edged out of the corner and approached the window overlooking the ruins of the palace. She peered out. Badal, wielding a crystal sword, but not just any fragment. No, this was from the palace. It blazed in the girl's hand, blinding enough to make Braderal snatch her head back in pain. The palace was destroyed, yet somehow it lived on. She hated this city.
"And now it is Badal who hunts me. She will drive that shard into my chest, and it will drink deep."
She needed to hide. Badal turned at a scuffling sound from one of the towers. catching a glimpse of a face pulling back from a small window halfway up. Was it time, then? So soon? She could unleash the power of her voice. She could, she knew, compel Brederal to come to her. She had been able to overwhelm four adult quitters. One of their children, weak and alone, would be unable to defend herself. But she wanted this death to be a silent one. After all, the battle between these two forces of righteousness had already been decided. The peace that was death had been rejected.
But of course we have been fighting that war since the very beginning. Fighting, and now we have won. It's over.
Would they live here forever, then? Could the orchard sustain them? What would they do? Was simple survival enough reason to go on living? What of dreams, desires? What kind of society would they shape?
No, this is not enough. We cannot stay here. It's not enough. Killing Brederal will achieve nothing. No, I have a better answer.
She raised her voice.
Child of justice, this city is not for you. You are banished. Return to your kind if you can. Go!
She heard a weak cry from the tower. The quitters had driven them from their homes, from their families. It was fitting, then, that she now drive from her home a quitter.
My home, my family. Not hers. It was never hers. This family, it is mine. And wherever they are my home.
They were done with Brederal. Badal set off to return to Rut and Held and Sadik. There were things to discuss, a new purpose to find, something beyond just surviving.
Something we deserve, for we have earned the freedom to choose.
She glanced down at her makeshift sword. It seemed unaccountably bright, as if gathering all the light it could drink. Golden flames seemed to glitter in its heart. It was beautiful, yes, but there was something else there, something of power, a terrible power. She remembered, from somewhere, tales about weapons, and those weapons were given names. Thus, she would name hers Fire.
Fuck!
Fiddler spun away from the three worried faces, the sets of frightened eyes, the twitches of incipient panic. He scanned the ground.
Stay where you are, he told the heavies. No, wait. Short Nose, go and get Bottle. Flashwit, you and Mayfly enforce a cordon round here, especially their tent. No one gets in, understood?
Solemn nods from the soldiers, and then Short Nose set off at a lumbering run. On all sides the camp was breaking, tents dropping down, stakes rocked loose from the hard, stony soil. Soldiers shouted, complained, and bickered. The smell of spicy food from the kitchen tents wafted in the cool morning air. Closer by, two other squads were looking over, uneasy, bereft of answers. They'd slept sound, they said, heard nothing. Fiddler's gaze drew back to the tent, slashed to ribbons. Inside, what was left of inside, the cots bore rumpled bedding, but no blood.
Fuck, fucking fire.
His breath slowly hissed as he resumed studying the ground, seeking tracks, signs of a scuffle, anything. Nothing caught his eyes.
Too scared to concentrate. Where in Hood's name is Bottle?
Flashwit had come to him half a bell earlier. He'd barely crawled out from his tent to find her standing in front of him, a look of dread on her broad face.
They're gone, Sergeant.
What? Who's gone?
Their tent's all cut up, but no bodies.
Flashwit, what are you talking about? Whose tent? Who's gone?
Our sergeant and corporal, gone.
Gessler? Stormy?
Their tent's all cut up?
Not cut up, he discovered, after following Flashwit back to the 5th Squad's camp. Slashed. The thick canvas was rent from all sides, with what must have been frenzied zeal. And of Gessler and Stormy there was no sign. Their weapons and armour were gone as well.
And the heavies were in tents to either side, barely room to walk between them, and in the dark with all the guy ropes and stakes. No, this doesn't make sense.
He turned to see Short Nose and Bottle jogging up to where stood Mayfly, who held out thick arms as if to bar their passage.
Let him through, Mayfly, but no one else. Not yet, anyway. Bottle, get over here.
What's this I hear about Gessler and Stormy deserting? Fiddler almost cuffed the man. Instead, he hissed,
Ain't nobody's deserted, but now that rumour's on its way, isn't it, idiot?
Sorry, Sergeant. It's too damned early in the morning for me to be thinking straight.
Better wake up fast, Fiddler snapped.
He pointed at the tent.
Look for signs all round it. Someone had to walk in to get that close. And if you find a single drop of blood, let me know. But quietly, understood?
Licking his lips as he eyed the ravaged tent, Bottle nodded and then edged past his sergeant. Fiddler unstrapped and drew off his helm. He wiped sweat from his brow, glared across at the nearby squads.
Wake up your sergeants and all of you! Make sure we got a full cordon!
The soldiers jumped. Fiddler knew that news of his sickness had gone through the ranks. He'd been down for days, stinking with fever. Standing close to Anamanda Rake had been miserable enough, he recalled, but nothing compared to this. He didn't need the deck of dragons to know what he knew. Besides, nowhere in the deck would he find a card called the Consort of Darkness. At least, not that he knew of, though sometimes powers were of such magnitude, such insistence, that they could bleed the paint off a minor card and usurp it. Maybe that had happened with his deck, but he wasn't about to shuffle through for a look. In any case, his being down had scared people. Damned unfair, but there it was, nothing Fiddler could do about it. And now that he was back on his feet, well, he could see far too much undisguised relief in too many eyes. The older he got, he realized, the more sensitive his talent, if it could be called talent. He preferred curse. Now Rake went and got himself killed. Unbelievable. Insane. Dragnipur is in pieces. Oh, sure, Rake and Hood made sure most of the monsters chained within it were wiped out. Nice deal, that. Chained souls and Hood's own menagerie of scary malcontents all fed into chaos. The dead will sleep and sleep forevermore. Amen. He clawed at his beard. Barely 3 days on foot again, he still felt wobbly, and now this. They've been snatched, right out from the middle of a whole damned army. Gessler, Stormy, why them? Oh, don't be obtuse, Fid. They were annealed in the forge of Thirlan, ascendants both. So think about that. Gessler, he can throw a punch heavy enough to stagger a god. Stormy can swing a sword through 3 bodies if he's mad enough. But not a drop of blood.
Found a drop of blood, Sergeant.
Bottle was suddenly at his side, head lowered, voice barely a whisper.
Just one? Well, maybe 2 drops together. A dollop? It's thick and it stinks.
Fiddler scowled at the man.
Stinks? Not human blood. Oh, great. Demonic? More like Rizan.
Rizan?
This ain't the time for jokes, Bottle.
I'm not. Listen, there's not a trace, not a single footprint beyond the kind soldiers make. And we both know it wasn't no soldiers jumped the tent and the 2 men inside it. Unless they had talons long as swords, and it was talons that did in that tent. But the hands they belonged to were huge. It gets stranger, Sergeant.
Hold on, let me think a moment.
Rizan?
Flit around at night, eating insects, small bats, winged.
They got fucking wings. It came down out of the sky. Of course, it's bloody obvious now. That's why there's no tracks. It just dropped straight down onto the tent.
Then someone should have heard it. At the very least, Guess and Stormy would have been screaming.
Aye, that part still doesn't scry.
Let me examine the tent, Sergeant. Pick it apart, I mean.
Go ahead.
Fiddler walked over to Shortnose.
Another trip for you. Find Captain Faradan's sort and maybe Fist Keneb. And Quick Ben, aye, get Quick Ben first and send him here.
And listen, Shortnose, don't say nothing about desertions. We already got enough of those. Gessler and Stormy didn't desert. They were kidnapped. Shortnose shook his head.
We ain't seen or heard nothing, Sergeant. And I'm a light sleeper. Stupid light, in fact.
I'm guessing some kind of sorcery silenced the whole thing. And the demon was winged. It just picked them both up and flew off into the night. Now go on, Shortnose.
All right. Quick, Ben, Salt, and then Keneb.
Right. Turning back, he saw Bottle on his hands and knees, lifting up shreds of canvas. The soldier looked up, nodded him over. Fiddler joined him, crouching at his side.
What is it? Everything stinks, Sergeant. Feel this cloth. It's oily.
That's what keeps him waterproof.
Not this stuff. This stuff smells like a lizard's armpit.
Fiddler stared at Bottle, wondering when the fool last jammed his nose into a lizard's armpit, then decided that some questions just should never be asked.
In Carl? Could be. But it would have had to have been a big one. Old, probably female. And somehow it got its hands round both their mouths, or round their necks. Then guess and store me a dead, whispered Bottle. Quiet, I'm still working through this. I can't recall ever seeing an Incarl big enough to fly carrying two full-grown men. So, Loki Weaval? Draconic lapdogs? Not a chance. A bull Incarl masses more than a Weaval. But then Weaval fly in packs, in clouds, I think it's called. So if a dozen came down, striking fast, maybe. But all those wing beats? No, somebody'd hear the ruckus for certain. So, not Weaval, and probably not an Incarl. What's that leave us with? Bottle stared at him. Dragon?
Do dragons smell like risen armpits?
How the hood would I know?
Bottle demanded.
Calm down, sorry I asked. But it doesn't work anyway, said Bottle after a moment. The slashed tent. The rents aren't big enough for a dragon's talons or teeth. And if a dragon did swoop down, wouldn't it just pick up the whole thing? Tent, people, cots, the whole works?
Good point. So we're back to a giant Rizan?
I was just saying what it smelled like, Sergeant. I didn't mean a real Rizan, or even one of those slightly bigger ones we got round here.
If it wasn't for the wings, muttered Fiddler, I might think Kachain Chimal.
They died out 100,000 years ago, Sergeant. Maybe even longer. Even the ones Hedge went up against at Black Coral. They were undead, so probably stinking of crypts, not oil.
Quick Ben arrived, pushing through the crowd that had gathered.
Short Nose said something about, shit, they have a cat fight or something?
Snatched, said Fiddler. Something with wings, big enough to shut them both up. Not a sound, Quick. Smells like magic.
Like lizards, you mean, cut in Bottle. Look at this, High Mage.
Quick Ben held out a hand and Bottle gave him the strip of canvas.
Lizards, Bottle? Feel the oil?
This is Kachain Chimal.
They ain't got wings, objected Fiddler. But Quick Ben was squinting skyward. Under his breath, he said,
Some do.
But no one heard a damn thing, Quick.
The oil is like the breath of a dragon, Fid, just not as virulent. It came down, sprayed the tent, took off again. The stuff soaked through, filled the air in the tent, and inside you could have knocked their heads together and neither one would have woken up. So it came back down, sliced through the tent to keep all the guys and stakes in place, and took them both.
You can't know all this, Bottle began, but stopped at a look from Fiddler.
Quick, Ben. You snake-eyed, shifty, know-it-all bastard from the bunghole of Seven Cities. I never liked you, never trusted you, even when I had to. The things you know about, why I...
Bottle blurted.
Quick! The strings you tied, they weren't snapped. Then they're still alive, right? You tied strings to them, to Gessler and Stormy. You did, didn't you?
Got lazy, Quick Ben said with a slow blink. Had too many. It was hard concentrating, so I cut down on them, Bottle. Didn't even think about Guess and Stormy.
You're lying.
Head back to the squad, Bottle, said Fiddler. Help Tar get us ready to march.
Sergeant, get out of here, soldier.
Bottle hesitated, and then, jabbing a warning finger at Quick Ben, he stalked off.
Strings still humming, Quick? Listen, Fid, I cut 'em just like I told Bottle.
Don't even try.
Yeah, well, you ain't Whiskey Jack, are you? I don't have to answer to you. I'm High Mage now, and that means... It means, do I have to talk to the adjunct directly, or are you gonna keep spinning round on that flagpole? How long can you keep up the puckered butt, Quick?
All right. They're alive, I know that much. Close by? No, a Shigal assassin can fly 200 leagues in a single night. A what? Never mind. Why those two? No idea. I hear the adjunct's a damned dragon herself these days. Fine, I figure someone needed them. A Shigal assassin Kachin Chimal needed Gessler and Stormy? Shigal. But they don't go rogue, not this way anyway. Meaning it was sent to find them. Sent by who? Quick Ben licked his lips, looked away and then shrugged. A matron, obviously. A matron? A Kachin Chimal matron? A real, live, breathing Kachin Chimal matron? Keep it down, will you? People are looking. We can...
Fiddler's helm caught the high mage flush on the side of his head. Watching the wizard fall in a heap was, for Fiddler, the most satisfying experience he'd known in years. He stepped back, glad round.
High Mage Quick Ben needs to commune with his gods. Now all of you, finish breaking your camps. We march in half a bell. Go!
Fiddler stood, waiting for the captain and Fist Keneb. His threats about the adjunct had come back to sink fangs deep into his backside. They'd need to talk to her. With Quick Ben up and awake and cornered with nowhere to hide. She could take over resting answers from the smug bastard. For himself, he glanced down at the unconscious wizard. He'd had enough. Never liked him. Need him, count on him, pray for him, love him, aye. But like him? Not a chance. Goat sticker, doll maker, soul eater. Probably soul taken or diverse too, if I'm any judge of things. Whiskey Jack, did you hear the sound it made hitting his head? This old helm of mine? Did it stir the dead all around you? Did you all sit up, rush to the gate? You looking in on us right now, Sarge? Hey, all you bridge burners, how'd I do?
Fist Keneb had ridden out alone just before dawn, passing through bleary-eyed pickets and cantering eastward until the sun broke the distant horizon. He reined in on a slight rise and sat slumped in the saddle, steam rising from his horse, low mists scudding over the broken ground as the air slowly warmed. The wastelands stretched before him. To his right, and now slightly behind him, the vague smudge of the Safi Mountains rumpled the southern skyline. He was exhausted, but insomnia plagued Keneb. He had been more or less running the Bone Hunters since leaving Lether. Fist Blistig had done his best to evade the responsibilities of command. He was in the habit of wandering among his soldiers in the evenings, eager to tell tales of the chain of dogs and the fall at Arran, as if no one had heard them a dozen times before. He'd drink with them and laugh over loud and play at being a comrade of no special rank. As a consequence, he was viewed with amused contempt by his soldiers. They had enough friends. They didn't need their fist spreading his hams on a crate at the fire, passing a jug. Such nights should be rare events, on the eve of battle, perhaps, but even then no one should ever be permitted to forget an officer's position. Blistig wanted to be one of the lads, but he was a fist by rank, and that meant standing apart from his soldiers. Staying watchful, aye, but ever ready to command and expecting that command to be followed. He was supposed to lead, damn him. At the morning briefing sessions, Blistig sat scowling, hungover, thick-tongued and bored. He ventured no ideas and looked upon every suggestion with something between disbelief and outright derision.
We need better than that. I need better than that.
The adjunct had the right to expect that her fists could manage the army on this march. She had other issues to chew on, whatever they were, and Keneb was nowhere near close enough to even imagine what they might be. In fact, no one was, not even Lostara Yil. There were two sub-fists, each commanding regulars, foot, skirmishers, scouts and archers, and Keneb found he was growing far too dependent on them with the logistical demands. They had enough of their own concerns to deal with, after all. But both were veteran officers, seasoned campaigners, and Keneb drew heavily on their experience. Though he often felt, as he once had when he'd been a young captain under the stubbled wing of a sergeant, neither Hobble nor Kellant likely had much good to say about him behind his back.
Aye, that's the truth of it,
I just managed as a captain. I'm far past my level of competence here, and it's showing. The wastelands looked forbidding, perhaps even more lifeless than the worst stretches of seven cities between Arran and Raraku, or that northwest push to the walls of Ygatan. He'd managed to acquire an honest list of warlocks and witches among the ranks, those possessing magics that could conjure forth edible plants, small mammals, insects and such from even the most miserable of lands, and water as well. To stretch out the supplies they carried, he had them hard at work supplementing daily rations allotted each squad. But the complaints had already begun. "These wastelands, Fist, are well named. Damn near sucked lifeless underfoot. Finding stuff is starting to hurt." "Do what you can. It's all I can ask." A more useless response from an officer was beyond his imagining, and what soured the most were his own recollections of receiving such inane replies from his commanders all those years ago. At last he understood the helplessness they often suffered when attempting to deal with something that couldn't be dealt with things and forces beyond any hope of control. "Just say what you can, and look confident and reassuring when saying it. Nobody buys it, and both sides know that fact, so what's really being acknowledged is the motions we both go through." Indeed, he was beginning to truly understand the burdens of command, a phrase he used to scoff at and mock derisively. "Burden, sir? Try carrying this kit pack on your shoulders all day, up and down hills and worse. What do you know about burdens? Shut that whining, sir, before I slide my knife across your scrawny throat." What did Blistig know about the whirlwind? He'd been cozy behind the walls of Arran, commanding a bored garrison. But I was in the middle of it, half dead of wounds before Kalam Mekar showed up. "Sister, where are you now? Was turning your back on him worth it?" Keneb shook his head. His thoughts were wandering, exhaustion pulling loose the tethers. "What haunts me now? Yes, now I remember. The army." Without hate, what army could function? Unquestionably, other things were needed. Respect, duty, the slippery notions of honour and courage, and above all of those, the comradeship between soldiers and all the responsibilities that created. But hate had a role, didn't it? Useless officers, unreasonable orders, the pervasive conviction that the ones in overall command were all incompetent idiots. But then, all of that means we're all in this together. We're all trapped in this insane, bloated family where every rule of behaviour strains near to snapping. And we're a family bred to answer everything with violence. Is it any wonder we're all so badly messed up? He heard the pounding of horse hoofs and twisted round in his saddle to see a soldier from his staff quickly approaching. Now what? But then he didn't really want to know. Any more desertions, real or otherwise, and he'd start to hear the spine cracking, and he dreaded that sound more than anything else, because it would mean that he had truly failed. The adjunct set this one task upon him, and he'd proved unequal to it, and as a consequence the entire Bonehunter's army was falling apart. Blistig needed to be pushed aside. He could think of a number of officers sharp enough to take on the role of Fist, Faradan Sort, Raband, Ruthan Gud, Kindly. Kindly, now there's an idea. Has seniority, instills a healthy dose of terror in his soldiers. Brilliantly unreasonable. Aye, Kindly. Now all I need to do is convince the adjunct. The rider reined in.
Fist, the adjunct requests your presence in the subcamp of the 5th Squad, 9th Company, 8th Legion. There has been an incident.
What kind of incident?
I don't know, sir. Captain Yill didn't say.
Keneb glanced back at the rising sun, and then the stretch below it. Wastelands. Even the name leaves a sick feeling in my gut. Let's go then, Bulge. On the way, you can amuse me with another story about Master Sergeant Paws. The scarred man's round, pocked face split into a smile.
Aye, sir. Got plenty.
They set out at a brisk canter. After relaying Fiddler's orders to the squad, Bottle returned to the 5th Squad's camp. He found a solid cordon round it and was forced to use his sergeant's name to push his way through. The three heavies were sitting close to a weak dung fire, looking morose. Fiddler stood close to the motionless, prostrate body of Quick Ben. Alarmed, Bottle hurried over.
What happened? He try a quest?
You back again? I sent you away, soldier.
Not a good idea, Sergeant. You shouldn't have let Quick try anything.
Why?
Bottle pointed down.
That's why. He's still alive, isn't he? He'd better be.
Aye. Now watch this about avoiding any magics, Bottle.
Small stuff is fine. Food, water, all that. But I wouldn't even think of doing anything bigger. First off, the wastelands might as well be dusted in Ortataral. Attempting sorcery here is like pulling teeth. Most places, that is. But there's other, places where it's the damned opposite.
Back up, soldier. You're saying there's areas out there where magic comes easy? Why didn't you mention this before? Our warlocks and witches are half dead right now.
No, no, it's not like that, Sergeant. It's not areas, it's people. Or more accurately, things. Ascendants stinking with power.
Bottle waved one hand eastward.
Out there, just, I don't know, just walking around. And they bleed, energies. Sure, we could feed on them, Sergeant, but that would mean getting close to them, and close is probably a bad idea.
Quick Ben groaned. Bottle frowned down at the High Mage.
Is that a welt on the side of his head?
How close to us is the nearest thing, Bottle?
I know the smell of one of them, Tlani Mas.
Really?
The word was flat, dangerous.
Still far away, Bottle hastily added. There's nothing within 20 leagues of us, that I know of. Some ascendants are good at hiding.
You winging out there, Bottle? How often?
Hardly at all, Sergeant. It's scary out there. In the dark, I mean.
Bottle was beginning to regret coming back here.
What's with me, anyway? Sticking my nose into every damned thing. And if it stinks real bad, what do? I go find something else to stick my nose in. And they all stink. You'd imagine, wouldn't you, I might quit the habit. But no, of course not. God's Bottle, listen to yourself.
Quick Ben sat up, cradling his head.
What? He asked. What?
Took a fall there, High Mage, said Fiddler.
A fall?
Aye, I'm thinking you were struck with a thought.
Quick Ben spat, gingerly probing the side of his head.
Must have been some thought, he muttered. It's so hard I can't even remember it.
Happens, said Fiddler. Listen, Bottle, wasn't it Tlani Mas who kidnapped Gessler and Stormy? It was what we talked about before, to change him all.
Wait, said Quick Ben. Who said anything about Tlani Mas?
I did, Bottle replied. You were the one talking about winged K'change Himal.
Fiddler snorted.
No doubt the adjunct will talk to us about the fucking Fokral Asael. Who's left?
Oh, the Jaghut.
Still days away, said Bottle and Quick Ben in unison, and then glared at each other. Fiddler's face reddened.
You bastards, he hissed under his breath. Both of you, we've got a Jaghut tracking us?
Not one, admitted Bottle. I counted 14. Each one a walking armory. But I don't think they're actually following us, Sergeant, unless our High Mage knows more about it, which is possible.
Fiddler had buried the fingers of one hand in his beard and looked ready to start tearing loose handfuls.
You reporting all this to the adjunct, Quick?
The High Mage scowled and looked away.
I've given up. Nothing surprises her, Fid. It's as if she already knows.
Bottle, any hint of K'change Himal? Your nightly explorations go out how far?
Depends on how crowded it is out there, Bottle admitted. But thinking on it, there's plenty of agitation going on, especially among the winged stuff, the Rinnazan, the Cape Moths. The scaled rats keep massing and setting off on wild paths, as if trying to follow something. Oh, and I've caught the occasional scent on the winds, but I took those to be draconic. I don't even know what a K'change Himal smells like.
Quick Ben flung the scrap of canvas at Bottle.
Yes, you do.
It dropped at Bottle's feet.
Right, he said, looking down at it. Oily lizards.
Draconic, said Fiddler. Forgot about those.
Anyone we know, Quick?
You're asking me? Bottle's the one smelling them.
I am. Well?
The wizard hesitated and then said,
"Aye, we bloodied him at Letharas."
"Can't keep a fly from buzzing your shit," said Bottle, earning hard looks from both men. "Look, the wastelands may be all wastes, but they ain't empty, Sergeant. I'm wagering the High Mage here suspects why it's so crowded. In fact," he added, "I think you know too, Sergeant, that pig of a reading you did, and then what hit you a few days back. Someone showed up, and you probably know who."
"Bottle," cut in Fiddler, "just how much do you really want to know? I told you to keep your head down, didn't I? Now here you are, and here comes the adjunct and Yill. I sent you back to the squad for a reason, soldier. You should have listened. Now it's too late."